So moving on to this week's sermon, the title is the second part of the journey to the promised land. It's a pretty much a continuation from last week's. So just for a tip, pretty sure most of you guys are already doing this, but for the Bible, like before the new book of, like before the new chapter starts, like there is usually like an introductory paragraph or a passage. So if you read that, you could have a really good idea of what this chapter or the whole book is going to be about. So just recommend that you guys read that before meditating on any other words. So up to last week, we have looked at chapters 1 through 5, which were the introductory part of the book of Numbers. So in terms of the historical events, Numbers take place after the covenant has been made with God at Mountain Sinai, and after God telling his people how to live according to his words and commands as evinced from Leviticus. Now in Numbers, it's a story of what happens after all these preparations have been made. So we get to actually see how these people are living as God's people. So this book is really the application of the things that we have looked at from Leviticus and Exodus and even in Genesis. So through Numbers, we can actually witness and examine our faith, because Numbers is pretty much a reflection of how those people back then have lived a faithful life in their individual sectors. So based on their stories, you could actually kind of compare your life with their lifestyle. In chapters 1 through 10, the context of the story still takes place in Mount Sinai. They were preparing for their final departure to the Promised Land. However, in chapter 5, we're able to see the disorderly behavior of these people because they weren't able to adapt correctly to God's words. If we are to map out the big picture of Numbers here, we can actually see that the religion of Christianity, is not some kind of magical or mystic religion. Rather, this religious belief of Christianity requires something more profound than that. It's not like a simple or light religion that you could take, you know, lightly. So through Numbers, God is revealing to us that it is a constant struggle between our old selves or old behaviors and our new selves and new behaviors in our individual lives. So we have this constant struggle, and he's revealing that there is this struggle going on in our lives. And we can actually see how this is, the sufferings that these people go through in order to maintain their godly ways and values. So let us remember this point as we read and study further on Numbers. So now we're starting on the new chapter of chapter 6. So in chapter 6, we're able to see the rules and regulations of the Nazarites, which was something that was mentioned in Leviticus. And perhaps the purpose of these regulations was to firstly calculate the numbers of people, the population, and to actually find Levites who are willing to commit fully to God's works, including maintaining the sanctuary. So as evidenced from the previous chapters, such as chapter 3 verse 10, we can see that the duty of maintaining the sanctuary was solely given to the Levites. And anyone else, assuming people who are not holy, who approaches the sanctuary, must be put to death. That's how sacred this job was. Thus, God has granted certain duration for anyone else who wanted to devote to the work at the sanctuary. He has given them certain duration for them to be committed. It wasn't like, you know, if people felt like, you know, rocking up the sanctuary one day and start working there. It didn't work like that. You have to have a specific permission from God himself. So for Nazarites, we can see that they will be given the same kind of permissions as Levites, and therefore work at the sanctuary, because the rules and regulations given to Nazarites were very similar to the Levites. The rules and regulations of Nazarites, including it included abstaining from wine and other fermented drinks. And the second rule was that no razor may be used on their heads. And the third regulation was not to go near a dead body. So even if their family members pass away, they're not allowed to go near the corpse. These rules were a mandatory provision because they apply to the priest as well as to the chief priest. So these three regulations, I mean, they seem pretty unique, very strange, and kind of uncommon, for example, going near the dead body and stuff. But there are reasons why God has chosen these three provisions, and these provisions or these regulations cannot be overturned or cannot be rebutted. And now we'll look at these three regulations in detail. So firstly, the rule of abstaining from drinking the wine or fermented drinks relate to the incident where Aaron's sons and Nadab and Abihu were killed because they have lighted the wrong kind of fire during the sanctuary ceremony due to their drunkenness. So basically they kind of used the wrong fire, I guess, to light up the fire at the sanctuary. And the reason for that was because they were drunk. And basically because of that mistake, they were put to death. So this regulation could be seen as, it kind of relates to that story or to that incident. So let's think about this for a moment. There's so many regulations and rules that could have come before this one. However, God has purposely mentioned this rule above anything else. He's revealing to us about how we should act or react to drinking. And based on the real research done by UC San Diego in 2018, so even one glass of drink can affect the person's decision-making ability. Because back before this, like people are saying, oh, what can one drink do to you? Or what can two drinks do to you? It literally doesn't do anything. But actually, there is some kind of legitimate research done to back this thesis. They have emphasized, the UC San Diego, the research department have emphasized that drinking after even one glass can be detrimental. I think this is the kind of trend that we see in our lives as well, in this world as well. Even in Korea last year, they passed another law that even regulates more harshly on drunk driving. And in terms of rules on drinking, there's no really like direct verses in the Bible that expressly prohibits drinking. However, there are many verses that infer that drinking should be prohibited when dealing with God's works. So again, even though it doesn't expressly prohibit you from drinking, it does have a lot of verses saying you shouldn't, it's kind of inferring that you shouldn't be drinking when you're dealing with God's work. But technically speaking, we're supposed to do God's work 24/7, right? And other than when the wine was recommended in 2 Corinthians, when it was used as a medicine, and also when people were rejoicing of God in Deuteronomy, the rest of the Bible actually only talks about prohibiting drinking. It never recommends drinking. And to be living as a body of Christ is to live a holy life by differentiating ourselves from others. And here, there must be a purpose behind why God is asking the Nazarites to be more holy and more holy by not drinking the wine and the fermented drinks. So I mean, like, if you there's people out there who drink a can of beer or a glass of wine every day because for their health. And the Bible doesn't really suggest that that's actually a bad thing if it's actually being used as a medicine. But of course, anything for other purposes, we should think about abstaining away from drinking. So every year, we ask the new leaders to sign a written pledge, or written oath. And within that statement, there is a provision about abstaining from drinking completely. And the reason behind this correlates with the purpose behind rules and regulations being enforced on the Nazarites. So God has already asked us to differentiate ourselves from non-Christians in this world. And for those of us who have made a commitment to being the leaders of the church and to other Christians, should live a life that differentiates even more, meaning more regulations should strictly follow. And the most important of that would be to abstain from drinking. So the pastor is giving additional explanation on drinking. So he's talking about drinking of offering, where the drinks were actually used to give offering to God. But that doesn't really necessarily mean that because you're offering the drinks to him, doesn't actually mean that it's for us to actually drink and enjoy. It's very different from many other traditions, such as like Vikings. That's how they enjoyed it. That's how they felt like they were engaging with their gods. But our religion, this religion of Christianity, is very different because God is not saying, oh, give me an offering of a wine so that we could all enjoy together by drinking. He's not saying that. But there are so many verses in the Bible, as I mentioned earlier, that actually go against drinking. So before really jumping into a conclusion that, you know, oh, this verse says like these Christians were enjoying drinking, before we jump into that conclusion, let's look at the entire context and really try to dig the true meaning underlying those events. So just think about this for a moment. We are actually trying to do God's work here. And even with our right minds, even though we are sober, it is still hard to do the work of God. And just imagine having a drink or two would definitely hinder us. Hinder our ability to make decision making in the light of doing God's work. So regardless of what era, which era we're living in, as long as we understand the proper purpose or meaning behind these regulations, we should be able to apply them in our lives. So moving on to the second regulation, the purpose underlying the rule of not using a razor to cut their hair is that God wanted his people to eradicate the previous bad habits and practices. The priests of foreign gods in many countries, such as Egypt, have this weird practice of shaving their heads and even their eyebrows. Does God want his people to discontinue that practice? In the present world, we can see that God doesn't want us to focus too much on the trend that is going around in this world. Rather, he wants us to maintain the genuine beliefs. We can't just be looking like a church or a Christian from the outer appearances. We need to actually be a genuine Christian. We see many churches adopting a new trend that doesn't necessarily comply with the words of God. And we need to eradicate these pointless trends completely. Furthermore, we must keep in mind that Christianity is not a religion with symbolism. Instead of looking for ways to be different through our physical appearances, such as our body or the church building even, for example, constructing big church buildings for the sake of it, should not make up this religion. And just thinking about why God has given us this regulation, we're able to see that He didn't want us to do anything else that doesn't relate to this religion, meaning anything else that might distract or might disillusion us from looking at the right path, looking straightforward to God's path, because that will likely lead us into sins. So when we actually worship God at church, we need to do it with our genuine hearts, and anything that might be superstitious should not even exist here. Any practice might indicate such things should not exist in church. And that's precisely the reason why God has given us this regulation. Thirdly, there are many interpretations to the rule of not going near the dead body. It could be a reason similar to the epidemic issue that we have looked at last week. And it could also be the fact that when we are showing our condolences to the dead body by bowing or doing some kind of respectful gestures, it may actually look like we're worshiping the dead bodies, the ghost spirits, to be more precise. It can also mean that sometimes the deaths occur due to sins, right? And thus, it can carry that symbolic meaning, which is for the Nazarites to stay far away from sins, which means that, so the best interpretation of this rule is that the Nazarites, the chosen people, should stay away from the sins. So it is not saying that we shouldn't be sorrow about our lost ones. It is telling us that it is very likely for the wrong spirits to be manipulating when we're doing the rituals, these kind of gestures to the dead body. Thus, instead of focusing too much on our dead souls, we should spend more energy, our energy, on saving souls. So, just remember that, don't be mistaken that this regulation is to keep you away from your parents when they pass away, or from your family members when they pass away. It's nothing like that. It's actually to kind of remind us that to be careful of these bad spirits, these ghost spirits that exist to manipulate us, to separate us from God. That's the purpose behind this third rule. So it is an obvious fact that by looking at these regulations that were enforced on Nazarites, the ones working in the name of God, were definitely unique in the sense that they had to live a very separate or differentiated life from the rest of the people. It is understandable that many of us don't want to live such lives where it seems like we're overtly standing out among others. We don't want to do that, right? It might seem very boastful, but God is clearly telling us today that it is okay to stand out, because that's the proof, that's the sign that you're living a holy life and differentiated life as a true Christian. It is absolutely okay for us to be criticized for trying to be different, but it is an absolute disaster if we get criticized for not living according to the words, because that's actually hindering God's glory from being shown. So we know that living a holy life as God's children can only be done by following the guidelines of God's words instead of chasing the earthly guidelines and values. So in that sense, we are going to stand out. You have to stand out in order to be doing that. And God is telling you that is absolutely fine. And while we follow His guideline, it is imperative for us not to adjust anything, but rather take the guidelines and lessons as face value. So what I mean by adjust is we cannot be just, you know, just changing the rules and regulations around in order to make it convenient for us. We just have to take those purposes and reasons for those rules and regulations and must take it as a face value and try to apply them into our lives. Now that we know the truth about differentiating ourselves, let's talk about our willingness. Is it true that just because you know the truth, you can't be walking on the road of salvation? God is actually telling us that yes, He can call us and lead us to the path of salvation, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we're automatically holy. He's exactly telling us that we can only be holy when we actually have the willingness to obey to His commands without any undue influence. Take Samson for an example. Even though God had called him to be holy, if he did not have the determination, then everything is useless. His strength doesn't actually come from his hair, but rather from his obedience to God, to his words, by being faithful to God's words. Therefore, we can say that being holy and being able to walk on the right path is not done by our own thinking and by just making adjustments to our own likings, but rather it's a calling from God, and it really does depend on our obedience. So these rules and regulations that we're talking about, God has invited us. God has basically told us, He's giving us the guideline that, hey, you want to differentiate yourselves from others? Follow these rules, follow these guidelines. I'm inviting you to do that so that you may join the kingdom of heaven. But you need to be the one who's determined to do it. You need to have the willing heart to do it. No one's gonna force you. God just gives you the calling and the invitation. That's it. It's up to you to meet Him halfway. And when we look at the New Testament, we can be assured that God has already called us to be His and that He has invited all of us to be holy. So let us not forget about these things as we try to live like the Nazarites who answer to God's calling. So this religion in a way is complex because God doesn't really literally tell you to not to do certain things. But if we know the purpose and inferences behind the things that God does reveal to us through the Bible, then we're able to see that, oh, we shouldn't be drinking, not even a glass. And we could, you know, see that maybe it's bad to do these things or bad to practice those behaviors, even though God doesn't explicitly say it, because we just know that that's probably what He would prefer for us to be doing or for us not to be doing. And now moving on to the next chapters. So chapter 7 has 89 verses. It's pretty long. And it talks about the offerings, the dedication of the tabernacle. And chapter 8 talks about an event where Levites are being cleansed. And we can see that the completion date of the tabernacle is not on the first day of January, but it's actually on the first day of February, and it has taken 2 years to build it. And as we can see from chapter 7, each of the 12 branches of families, different families, they make the same kind of offerings. And you might be wondering, what's the point of that? Like, why would they offer the same offerings like 12 times? But we can really see the sincerity here by each party. And each of them wanted to sincerely make the offering to God. The underlying message here is that there is no exceptional person in the eyes of God, and that we are all equal, and that everyone has God's attention all the time. So that happens at the church as well. Oh, just because someone's doing that, it doesn't necessarily mean that he's doing it on behalf of the church. It's an individual relationship, right? So it's an independent relationship. It's not like we have to go through the church like the Catholic do. We could have an intimate relationship privately with God. And God really loves that. God really loves it when we do it by ourselves, sincerely. So I tend to think this chapter as some kind of power switch. What I mean by that is, now that everyone's ready to take off, it's time for each one of us to turn on that engine. Just like how the ship is built in order to sail out to the ocean rather than to be parked at the port, God's people also need to sail out to the world instead of settling down under the God's shadow. In chapter 8, God has set apart the Levites from other Israelites and declared that Levites are His, and appoints Aaron and his sons to be the workers at the tabernacle. And now in chapter 9, there is a celebration of the Passover, and the date of this event is January 14th. And you might be thinking, oh, the date is a little off, right? Because I mentioned earlier that the tabernacle was completed on February 14th. But right now we're talking about January 14th. Well, the supposed date was January 14th, but because of various circumstances, there has been a delay. And there were a lot of people who couldn't keep the Passover in January. Thus, the Passover happening in chapter 9 is really, technically speaking, the second Passover for those people who couldn't actually practice the Passover in the month of January. So what is the underlying message here? In our lives, there are many times when we tend to push the dates for church-related stuff. Stuff meaning doing God's work. For example, your one-on-one Bible study session with your leader might have to be delayed because for some reason, right? Things happen in life. So, I mean, sometimes it's inevitable that we have to delay some kind of event, even though it might be, you know, relating to doing God's work. And that's fine. No one's going to criticize you for that, and no one should criticize you for that. But what we need to remember is that we can't just nonchalantly and vaguely delay it, meaning, you know, oh, let's just do it next time or something like that. It should be more precise. So rather than doing that, we need to be serious about it and try really hard to delay it to the nearest date as possible. So if your usual time of doing one-on-one independent Bible study is on Wednesday, and you have time on Thursday, the very next day, you shouldn't really wait until next Wednesday. But if you can, you should try to do it on Thursday. I mean, this is really a judgment call on, you know, individually. It might be different for individual person or their standards, but we could see that that's the point here with this chapter 9. So chapter 15 onwards talks about how the tabernacle has been used as an important source in communicating and interacting with God. It was also representative of the fact that God was with the people at the tabernacle, and that the cloud above the tabernacle was an indication that God has directly led His people to His kingdom. And finally, in chapter 10, the story of journey to the promised land begins. And God reveals to His people how to use the trumpets to communicate with one another throughout the journey. The rationale behind this communication method is that they're practicing in a manner that was already agreed by everyone. And this is actually the best method to communicate, right? So if you agree, oh, let's communicate in this way, if I blow the trumpet in this way, it means that, and if I blow it in this way, it means the other meaning. So they're doing it where everyone else, the entire army or entire people, have kind of agreed beforehand. And similarly, the best way to communicate with God is through practicing the things that were promised with Him. Thus, the sound of the trumpet symbolizes God's words and the covenant. As a result, God always comes through with His promise. But there are times when us humans, fail to communicate with God properly because we simply do not know or even forget what the promise and covenant made with Him were. So just like how these people, when they're on their way to the journey, they're blowing trumpets to kind of communicate with one another, and they were able to do that because they agreed on some kind of method for the proper communication to work. And same way, our relationship with God works the same way as well, right? So He made promises with us, and we promise to God that we are 100% committed to His covenant, and that we're 100% committed to His commands and His rules and regulations. But you know, God, He never fails, and He will always come through, but it's us who always forgets, who always, or not even know what those promises are in the first place. And that's the issue that's going on here. So to summarize chapters 1 through 10, in one train of thought, is this: while God's people were preparing for a departure, the most important lesson that comes out of it is that the members of church needs to be associated with the community and must know their own place, and concurrently, we must obey the promises and the order while being responsible to the duties that are given to us with the faithful and the willing heart. I mean, that's pretty big statement to kind of digest, but there's nothing that we didn't talk about in today's sermon. So erecting a good church, a good Christian church, it's not done by just a pastor, but it's like, it's a teamwork. And everyone knowing their own place and knowing what they need to do and having the willingness, having the determination to drive through it and to work together to make a good church. So before moving on to the journey to the land of Canaan, let us reflect back on how these people have gotten there. So the story of the beginning of the journey, we're gonna talk about it from next week. And before going into that, let us just kind of do a recap, right? Just reflect back on how these people have gotten there. The fact that the ancestors of these people were first gathered at Mount Sinai and was also saved from Egypt, from slavery, and the reasons for all of those things happening are all important lessons that we shouldn't forget. And this is the perfect time to kind of do a review of that. It is true that people put too much emphasis on crossing the Red Sea. And for some reason, we think that crossing it will make us, you know, complete, and that that's the most important event that has ever happened. However, God is clearly telling us today that nothing will be meaningful, even the splitting of the Red Sea will be meaningful, if we get to the land of Canaan, which is the promised land, if we don't actually know and realize our identity as the body of Christ. All those things were revealed to us in previous chapters. Thus, the journey to the promised land is important, but knowing our identity and realizing how we got to this point is also equally important. Salvation is not everything. It's not the means to the end, but rather it's just the beginning. Thus, after being saved from Egypt, the next step will be to promptly gather at Mount Sinai. To expediently gather at Mount Sinai. At Mount Sinai, we can find out our identities and can truly learn about who God is and what kinds of covenants He has made with us. Basically, it is knowing His words and purposes. And why is this important? Think about it this way. What's the point of going into the Promised Land if we do not actually know why we are there and what to do over there, right? We need to know His truth and purpose in order to properly carry out our duties at the Promised Land. So the question of why God has called me here is more important than asking about how and what we are going to do over there. Because knowing how to answer that question is really going to the heart of God. Unfortunately, many people fail to first gather at Mount Sinai. It's like those who have been saved but still wander around. And we have so many people like this at church. For example, it's like those refugees who are extremely fortunate to escape and seek asylum at some other country, but actually becoming thieves and anarchists. I believe that this is a very serious matter in Korean churches today. If we don't know who God is, and do not understand His purpose of calling us, then no matter where we are at, it could even be a heavenly-like place, we're always going to complain and be dissatisfied about everything. On the other hand, if we really understand those things, then we can rejoice even at the wilderness. And it may be the case that people might laugh and criticize us, but we will still be happy and rejoice. So don't be afraid to live accordingly, even though it feels like we're always a step behind everyone else, and ask God for the strength to live according to His words. It's better to be slow and going on the right path than to be fast and just not knowing where you are, or very unsure of whether you're going on the right direction. The Satan's always trying to distort us from knowing the truth of God, because that's the best way for us to be corrupted. Just be aware that Satan will try to lead you to some other things that are more enticing to us, to our human bodies, rather than finding out more about our God. However, we shouldn't be enticed or be tricked by those things. We need to get over the fact that crossing the Red Sea was amazing. Yes, it's amazing, but that's not the point, right? We must realize that there is a greater thing waiting for us at Mount Sinai. So let us go to the site where God's words exist, so that we may truly understand His purposes and covenants. This is the key to happiness. So even at church, you don't have to be volunteering. You don't have to be doing something for the church. Before you do that, that's all necessary and that's all very important work. But before you do that, you must truly understand the identity, and you must truly understand God's words and know His covenant that He has made with us. And when we know God's heart and our identities, then we're able to see the Promised Land. God didn't pick the land of Canaan as a promised land for no reason, right? It's a land where everyone can truly live according to His words and as God's priest. And at Mount Sinai, people were able to see why they needed to go there and what is it that they have to do over there. The land of Canaan is therefore truly a land that the holy people will go through before going to the kingdom of heaven. So let us remember these things and remember that the Promised Land will reveal to us when we truly understand the identity and the heart of God. You might be wondering, everything must happen so much easier if God didn't actually lead his people to the land of Canaan, where there are so many temptations and dangers along the journey. And just, you know, it would have been so convenient to just leave them at Mount Sinai, right? But we should not forget about the purpose for God to do this. People tend to look for things that are convenient and safe. However, God knew that people are likely to fall into corruption in those circumstances and in their comfort zones. And he really wanted to create an environment where his people who were chosen to be the priest in the chosen land. And God doesn't want us to live in the ghetto. In the past, the Jewish people purposely stationed certain people to live in the ghetto area. But in the present times, many of us willingly hide in our ghettos in order to stay away from the church. And surely God doesn't want the Christians, the chosen people, to just live amongst ourselves. Therefore, he wants his people to go out to the world where everyone can see. That's the reason of going to the land of Canaan, to the promised land. He wanted people to see the journey and people to see his people, his chosen people, the priest-like people, going to the land of Canaan to actually set up an environment where people could actually truly worship him. In other words, to live like Christians is to go out to the world and to be the light, instead of hiding in our own ghetto places or to just gather around the church and be happy with ourselves. I mean, what's the point of gathering at church every Sunday, just among ourselves? We need to actually go out to the real world and to spread the gospel. And God is clearly revealing to us that we shouldn't just stay in Mount Sinai, but we should set on a journey to the promised land. So our religious actions should not only exist in church, but should occur more in the outside world. So wherever you are throughout the week, it could be at your work. Your workplaces are very diverse, right? But you should always remember to be the salt and the light of God, so that God's promises and identity can be revealed to others as well. And if you don't have the strength, or if you are kind of lost in terms of how to be the salt and the light at your work or in your daily lives, then talk about it with your cell members and ask them for help, and encourage one another to achieve that goal. And so through Numbers 1 through 10, we have examined the final preparation before the departure. And from next week, we'll look at this, the start of the journey to the Promised Land. So look forward to that.